Well, I was speaking to Dr. Boyle at lunchtime, and I said, you know, the first session after lunch, the main task of the speaker is to keep the audience awake. So I said, how could you keep an audience awake with a title like that? John Monaghan is my name anyway, and I was... I come from this 1940s red brick hospital in the west of Ireland in East Galway, and I've been working there for the last 12 or 13 years, and it's a general, what might be called a district general hospital, delivering about 2,200 babies a year, and offering a general service in gynecology and then medicine, surgery and paediatrics. So it's about 200 beds. And if you go inside the building, then you may meet some of these people. I don't know. Can you see the pictures all right? Yeah. So you meet, might meet one or both of these people who are actually in the audience. Thought I might just introduce them and acknowledge them. There's Eileen Cahalan here and Mary O'Brien over here. And it's a very simple sort of system we operate. Eileen punches the papers here, and she passes them over here where they're counted. And we just go on like that all week. And as you can see, the notice board is divided down the middle. It's of equal responsibility. So you might get some idea of the personalities if you look at either side of the board. That's just a little joke. So... in our house, when our kids were growing up, we had these books arrived. One was called What's a Kid to Do, and it was later replaced by What's a Teen to Do. And they sort of dealt with issues that might arise with regard to, you know, interacting with other people and ethical things that teenagers might have when they grow up and so on. So I thought I might subtitle this talk, What's a Gynae to Do? And since I am actually, I discovered before lunch, a provider rather than a physician, I'm glad that I'm not a member of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. The reason I suppose I say that is that I consider myself to be a generalist. And this is a photograph. It's been around a bit, as you can see. It was discovered in the basement, I think, when we were moving house. But that's me at the age when I was deciding what a gynae would do. And I became a general gynecologist. Not that much exposure to fertility as a trainee, a certain amount. But I certainly liked the idea of conceiving naturally, which I think most people like that. And that was probably what drew me towards the NAPRO idea of care with regard to fertility and family planning issues. And I was just thinking, this was taken about 30 years ago, and I was asking, what has changed in the last 35 years since I started training? And 35 years ago, people knew about ovulation. They were treating ovulation. There were the drugs that were used today, that are in use today, or were available then. We knew about tubal patency, either laparoscopy or X-rays, and the male factor and semen analysis. They were all fairly well established. So the question might be, has anything changed in 35 years from the point of perspective of a general gynecologist? And of course, everything changed in 1978 when Louise Brown was born as a result of IVF, the first child born in the north of England. And this is Professor Edwards, her, I don't know what is, how you describe that relationship, her creator, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine last year. So Louise Brown is now an adult. But of course, the advent of IVF changed infertility practice, possibly forever. And I was thinking of what have been the consequences of the advent of IVF for a generalist or for somebody who might be interested in the NAPRO approach to infertility. And one of the things that's very notable in Ireland and probably in other countries is the disappearance of trained microsurgeons. There were two gynecologists in Dublin who were trained in microsurgery. They're both now retired and have not been replaced. Now, I sense that on the continent of Europe, there seems to be a revival in the idea of doing highly technical microsurgery for infertility. But I think there was a gap of about 25 years where nobody went into it. And there's a deficiency in the care of people, women who are trying to conceive naturally and need surgical correction of their disorders. the rise in multiple pregnancy obviously associated with it. Ethical issues, nobody needs to be reminded about those. Recently, in the last year in Ireland, there was a frozen embryos situation which went to the Supreme Court, and a woman was not allowed to implant her own embryos because her former husband objected to it. The ethical issues are enormous. I would suggest that there has been a lack of development because of the superovulation, the predictable nature of the treatment with IVF. I think it has inhibited people from looking at ovulation induction from a standard perspective. And I don't see any great development either in drugs or in drug regimes other than the superovulation regimes which are associated with IVF. And then, of course, there's the cost in that IVF is very expensive. This was from last week's Irish Medical News. And although the headline mightn't give the exact story, it says recession doubles public patient demand for IVF. That's people who are not paying for their own treatment. IVF, this is from the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin, for cost €4,700 per cycle. But the gist of the story is that in that demand for IVF, or the number of patients having IVF last year in the Rotunda Hospital, dropped by 10% for the first time ever. And that's economics. So that the cost of IVF is certainly a factor in an adverse economic climate. Now, these things were all available 20 to 35 years ago. Hysterosalpingography, laparoscopy, admittedly in a much less developed state. Clomiphene's been on the market, I'd say, since before anybody here was born. Gonadotrophins are, there are newer forms of them, but they're basically working the same way. And we knew about semen analysis, maybe not quite so well as we do today. So they're all old. So what's new? What's new, I suppose, is the huge growth in imaging, which affects all parts of medicine. Particularly MRI, which is, can be very helpful in the assessment of things like endometriosis, and, of course, ultrasound, which is very important in both IVF and in NAPRO. Laparoscopic surgical techniques over the last 15, 20 years have increased. The level of skill and expertise has increased greatly. And certainly, I don't claim to be an expert by any means, but looking at the level of technical proficiency that people have in laparoscopic surgery nowadays, some of it is stunning, I would say. And then many of the developments, a lot of the developments that we might know about in gynecology could be attributed indirectly or directly to to the advent of IVF. What I mean by that is that the whole thrust of discussion about infertility has changed from how a particular disease affects fertility as to how a particular disease affects IVF. And, for instance, the impact of endometriosis, which is mainly what I'm interested in talking about, is how does it affect IVF results rather than how does it affect fertility outcomes in general. So this meta-analysis, which is going back a few years, looked at 15 studies in relation on the relationship between endometriosis and IVF, and it fairly clearly said that IVF is less successful if you have endometriosis. There were lower rates of fertilization, lower rates of implantation, and lower hormone levels. Overall, quoted a 35% reduction in the possibility of pregnancy in a woman who's having IVF if she's got endometriosis. Not universally agreed. The other thing that has been stated is that the more severe the endometriosis, if you have stage 3 and 4 endometriosis, your results are poorer than if you have stage 1 and 2 endometriosis. Reasonable to understand that. This is a very poor quality video. I went to a meeting there a couple of months ago, and I was a fellow had magnificent pictures of a laparoscopy, and I asked him how did he do it, and he told me to buy an Apple computer, and I wouldn't have any problems. But I don't have an Apple computer. But this is an endometrioma. I don't know if it's clear at all. Can you see that? Or? Yeah. This is an attempt to remove an endometrioma from the left ovary. And it goes on for ages, but it gives you an idea if you're not familiar with this of what an endometrioma. That's not a big endometrioma; it's quite a small one. So the wall is being removed, and then the underneath is going to be treated. Sorry, we need to get out of that. How do I do that? And there we go. I've gone the wrong way. Poor fertilization. I seem to have gone into reverse. Does anybody know how to get... How did I do that? Oh, I'm down here. Yes, no, I haven't filled yet. Thank you. Yet. So the interesting thing about endometrioma and IVF is that that it's not widely agreed that endometrioma may affect your fertility as much as the other as endometriosis in general. And it's been suggested that after endometrioma or with endometrioma that the outcome for IVF is not impaired and that the ovarian response is not impaired. In addition, and this is of relevance for NAPRO, this is the main reason I put it up, if you do operate on endometriomas, which we do finish up doing in patients who are trying to conceive naturally, the bulk of the evidence would seem to suggest that if you remove endometriosis, you don't decrease the chances of conceiving in terms of damaging ovarian function. There's a couple of papers that do suggest it. This is cystectomy, and this would be removal, something a bit like what I was showing in the pictures there, removal of the wall and vaporization of the cavity of the endometrioma. However, to make it even more complicated, if you have bilateral endometriomas, it's suggested that you don't do as well as if you have a unilateral endometrioma. And the last part there deals with the fact that if you remove endometriomas in people who are having IVF, you have a significantly smaller ovary, which may disimprove the ability to collect eggs. Anti-Müllerian hormone is the flavour of the month for anybody who's doing involved in infertility as a measure of ovarian function, and in particular to whether it predicts the time when you will become menopausal. And it's been suggested that surgery has no effect on your AMH level. In other words, that it may not have any or shouldn't have any long-term effect on ovarian function. If you've got severe endometriosis, you have lower AMH levels. Last bit about the different types of endometriosis. Colorectal endometriosis, which we would usually regard as the most severe in terms of producing pain and a frozen pelvis, seriously damaging the pelvis. There's a study which is very recent which suggests that this study compared people with colorectal endometriosis with tubal infertility and male infertility, three groups of patients, and suggested that the people with colorectal endometriosis did as well as the people who had blocked tubes or who had male infertility. I'm not quite sure why that is, but it's somewhat reassuring to a surgeon like me who may not be very enthusiastic about getting involved in densely adherent colon to the back of the uterus. That's not to say that it shouldn't be done, but it's the major worry from a surgical perspective, and the thing that I would warn patients about first in terms of going ahead for surgery is the risk of a bowel injury from the lower colon or rectum being adherent to the posterior wall of the vagina. There's been a risk associated risk of IVF with endometriosis that it may cause it to activate or flare up, that endometriosis may deteriorate as a result of the hormonal treatment. That argument could also probably be used against people who are having NAPRO technology because you're also inducing ovulation frequently. And then the complications, which I'm sure many gynecologists would have seen, people with endometriomas who've got infected. And I've certainly seen it a couple of times where people became quite ill as a result of endometriotic cysts getting involved in the egg collection procedure. So, moving on more into the NAPRO area, the reason I went on so much about IVF is because that sort of sets the parameters of the research, the emphasis is on research. I think we can learn useful things from these studies. Now, who has endometriosis? Now, there's a school of thought that says that every woman has endometriosis. This is based on the fact that several studies have shown that 6% of people, if you just stick in a little thing and biopsy the pelvis, that 6% of people you'll find endometriosis in this random biopsy of tissue. Some people suggest that it will come and go, that you will have it at certain times of your life or certain times of the menstrual cycle even. And then others say that the spots or the visible lesions are only the external manifestations of an underlying disease. Rather, somebody compared it to the spots of measles. In other words, that's not the disease that you see. I'm not at all convinced by any of these arguments. And then the question about immune and genetic factors. Now, that's theoretical, if you like. What people do get is pain, other than infertility, and it's well known that drugs relieve the pain, but the pain nearly always returns. Surgery relieves the pain. Some people say it relieves it temporarily. Other people say it relieves it permanently. I'm sure in some cases it's temporary. So moving into the studies that might be more of more interest to us, this, I reprinted this, you probably can't read it, but it's what's called the Endocan study, and as I've met people from Canada already, they must be very proud of this, the world-leading study on the treatment of mild or minimal endometriosis. It was done in Canada and published in 1997 in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it said it was a very well-performed randomized trial where the patient was in theatre, the instruments were put in, the surgeon looked in and he saw endometriosis. Somebody went to a telephone and contacted the randomizing center, and they said treat or not treat. So it's regarded as a very well done randomized trial. And the results suggested that if you were treated, you had a 31% chance of conceiving within the subsequent 3 years, and if you weren't treated, it was 18%. The only other randomized trial that was done in Italy by GISE, it's called. This is the translation, I think, of GISE. And this was published 2 years later. And they didn't suggest there was any increase in fertility, although they were using JNRH analogues to suppress menstruation for some time after the surgeries, which was considered different from the Canadian study. So you put those two together. This is the number of patients in the Endocan study. This is the number in the other, quite a much smaller study. And this is the results which I've already shown you there on the bottom. So when you go to the Cochrane database, which is puts it all up on a table for you, I haven't got the table, the odds ratio is 1.64. It's greater than 1 here. And it suggests that if you treat minimal or mild endometriosis, the evidence suggests that fertility is improved. And that would be the rationale, I suppose, for what I do. I just leave this quote, leaving all that area behind then. The evidence as to what produces endometriosis or how it affects you is somewhat mysterious. But there is some evidence, this is not my quote, that treatment will affect both pain and fertility. So moving on to our hospital, where we've been, since about 2000, we've been doing cases. We had, this is a series or an audit of these 4 years. In the number of cases increased over that time. We finished up with 354 women who had treatment. What I mean by treatment is they had a procedure done. The procedure was most often a hysteroscopy and a laparoscopy, or a laparoscopy alone, or sometimes a hysteroscopy alone. And the only parameter was they had treatment or they didn't have treatment. So this is the result of that group of patients. And you'll notice that if you compare it to the Endocan group of patients, the age is significantly older. The distribution of the age is interesting in that there's almost nobody, well, very, very few of the 350 patients below 30 years of age. There's a peak here, and there seems to be almost a second peak here in the early 40s of people who've maybe had treatment before or are realizing that they're reaching the very end and they want to do something. And I think some of those are attracted to NAPRO treatment as a modality. This is the more recent, the last 2 years, and the breakdown is the same again. I think there seems to be a sort of peak of women in their early 40s. They had lots of other problems, and 14% of them would have had a male sperm problem. And in the last 2 years, looking at the males, there was 93 of which 28 had a sperm problem, and the fertility, the pregnancy rate in that group was significantly lower than the group as a whole. The only reason I'm mentioning male is because I think one of the biggest defects in the whole NAPRO and fertility in general is the absence of any realistic treatment for male infertility. And I bought this book there a year or two ago. I don't know if anybody's ever read it. I said I better try and find out something about it. But the photograph on the front sort of gives the game away in that this is an ICSI being performed, and there's really nothing about male infertility other than genetics and how to manage assisted reproduction. So if there's a young doctor out there, there's a life of studying male infertility. If you compare the amount of study that's been done on males compared to females over the years. Anyway, this group patient, quite a lot of them had previously IVF or ICSI, even up to 9 times. 89 of them had previously had IVF. Some of them had IVI. Overall, 32% of them had previous ART. And a significant, more than half of them had previously had an investigation of laparoscopy for infertility. some of them on a few more than one occasion. So the sort of things we did were diathermy for endometriosis, division of adhesions, ovarian drilling, ventral suspension, removal of peritubal cysts, removal of endometrial polyps, and some simple myomectomies and so on. So we tried to break it down then. This is just an example of if the people who had ovarian drilling for PCOS, as to what the results were. 19 conceived out of 69. The ventral suspension cases, 27% of them conceived. There was no distinct better pattern in those patients than in the patients as a whole. So I'm just going to present the whole group of patients, and that's, you know, it simplifies. So of the 354 women, 90 conceived, that's 25.4%. 16 of those miscarried, one ectopic, one molar pregnancy. Reassuringly, I suppose 23 of them had a subsequent pregnancy, and had three children in total. This is more modern. For the 2008-200 and 2009, we had 137 patients who had the same procedure done, and 31% of them conceived, which seems a slight improvement on what was in the 2003 to 2007 figures. Again, a high rate of miscarriage. Just comparing it to the Rotunda figures, which is the leading IVF unit in the country, the figures for these are about the same, if you want to compare them. Admittedly, they're only having one cycle of treatment. One of the things that interests me is that the number of people who went for IVF who didn't have a diagnostic laparoscopy beforehand, which I would consider to be insufficient investigation. So in 2003, there were four. In 2004, there were one. And then there were seven in 2006. And if we move on to the years 2008-2010, of 68 patients who had had IVF, 22 had never had a laparoscopy. So more and more people are going straight for IVF without going through orthodox traditional methods of investigation. I'm going to skip that because we're in time trouble. I may have to skip all those as well. I might go back, actually. Yeah, I want to go back to one of those. How am I doing on the time? Am I 2 minutes more? Oops, no, that didn't work. Pardon me. Should come to life. Don't mind the signals. I did pay for this program, even though it says trial version. This is somebody who had a previous laparoscopy. I don't know if you can see it very clearly. I can't see it very clearly from here. But it's to make the point about the title of the talk of near-field microscopy. I don't know if you can see anything there yet, but this is the ovary being lifted up here. There's a bit of a cyst on the ovary. But when you move in close, and that's the closeness, or even closer, and when I move away and move clearer, you can see how it disappears. There are multiple deposits of endometriosis here going all the way across. I better stop it, but it goes, you can see it here. And it's over here, and there's deposits here. There's endometriosis all over the place. And that's the point of the title of the talk that Dr. Boyle gave me, was that near-field laparoscopy is what will show you these lesions. I'm going to keep going because I'm in time trouble now. Conclusions, then. Overall, I'm suggesting that your chances of getting pregnant after surgery for... of conceiving spontaneously after surgery for primary or secondary infertility, mostly primary, is about 30%. The morbidity is low. I point out that it's not an investigation, but it's an investigation with treatment. I think that's the way, if you're involved in this, you should go. So everybody gets a bowel prep before they come into theatre, you know, the day before. Many patients are in the end of a long journey of infertility. Some of them are desperate and will try anything. Some of it's a special group of people that seem to go for napro in this country anyway. Some of them have had inadequate assessment beforehand. Many of them have multiple pathology, which makes it very difficult to say that ovarian drilling made them get pregnant when they also had fibroids. The safety is a crucial issue, and thankfully we've never had any really serious outcomes. I put in management of fibroids because that's a changing area. There seems to the other non-NAPRO people are suggesting that the removal of fibroids may be more significant than it was in the past. What I would have said a few years ago was if your cavity is distorted by fibroids, or you have fibroids jutting into the cavity, or multiple fibroids distorting the architecture of the uterus, they should be removed. I think the current feeling would be that those that are involving the cavity and those that are intramural should be removed. And many of these are being removed by minimally invasive surgery now. The male factor and its problems, I've already referred to that. So who needs surgery? Everybody needs a laparoscopy, I think, and for investigation and for treatment at the same time. And a small number need major surgery subsequent to a laparoscopy. A word about the future. The future doctor who's practicing gynecology in the manner that you're discussing here would be an experienced minimally invasive surgeon. He would be able to handle major surgery, including bowel resection. And I think that the PAIRS idea, or the adhesion prevention surgery of advocated by Dr. Hilges in America, is a very valuable approach to treating patients with surgically with infertility. A future specialist, I think, will have subspecialty training in endocrinology, and he will should be good at or have access to gynecological imaging. How you get this sort of training in a culture that rejects your principles is not my subject, but it's a significant issue which you might want to think about. And thank you for your attention. I'm sorry I went over time.